The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Jason Freeman. I work here in Author Events, and I am very pleased to be here to welcome Will Haygood, a Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist with an illustrious 30-year career. Will Haygood is best known for his 2008 Washington Post article, "A Butler Well Served by the Selection," a story about the White House steward who bore witness to some of 20th century America's most notable events and figures. This article later became the basis for the book entitled The Butler, and a movie of the same name directed by Philly's own, by the way, Lee Daniels. Haygood is also the author of popular biographies of Adam Clayton Powell Jr., Sugar Ray Robinson, and Sammy Davis Jr. And he is currently the Wheat King, visiting distinguished professor at Miami University of Ohio. His new book, Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America, probably tells you a little bit about what this book is about. It offers a revealing portrait of the 40-year career of one of the most transformative legal figures in U.S. history. Reviewers have said that Showdown is written with great energy, wit, and style, and that the author has done a great service by reminding us of an extraordinary man at an extraordinary point in our history. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you join me in offering a warm Philadelphia welcome to Will Haygood?
And when I was flying here, I ran into someone at the airport who recognized me as the writer of the Butler story that got turned into the movie that was directed by Philadelphia native and my good friend, I'm proud to say, Lee Daniels. And the person asked me if anything has changed in my life since the movie. Movie's won awards and it's played all over the world. And I had to be honest, and I told him, really, no, nothing. Nothing has changed in my life. I'm still the same cat I've always been. I am curious, however, about this. I have since heard from both of the ladies who turned me down for the high school prom. One said, now surely, Will, you aren't holding a grudge. And I said, now why would I hold a grudge about what happened on May 27th? At 2:30 in the afternoon, outside of Mrs. Simpson's homeroom class, when I asked you to go to the prom with me. As such is life. I've also heard from a lot of people who I really didn't know were my cousins. Showdown. I spent 5 years on this book. It was a very important book to me to do. I wanted to tell a story about Thurgood Marshall that no one had known. His hearings took place over 5 days, but those 5 days were stretched over a across 12 days. His nomination set in limbo for a month. All of that can be traced to the fact that he was the first black nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967. He had changed the legal landscape of the South, and the senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee, the leaders of that committee, were Southern segregationists. Lyndon Johnson was a very brave president when it came to civil rights. He didn't tell anybody in the U.S. Senate that he was nominating Thurgood Marshall. He wanted it to be a surprise. And I'm going to read three scenes, and this first scene is the day that Thurgood Marshall was summoned to the White House. On the morning of June 13, 1967, LBJ gathered some key members of his staff in the Oval Office. Among them were the aides Marvin Watson and Clifford Alexander. There was also Thurgood Marshall, who had been a federal appeals court judge and was the current Solicitor General, and also Louis Martin, a White House political advisor. Martin, a Negro, had known Marshall for years and looked upon him with an enormous amount of reverence. A butler served light refreshments to the small gathering. There was a feeling around the room of heightened emotion mixed with swooning, especially by all the Negroes who were present. Lyndon Johnson was going to nominate a Negro to the U.S. Supreme Court. He told no one save a very few close aides. He was not going to be talked out of it. "I want to do this job that Abraham Lincoln started," Lyndon Johnson had confided to a few aides about his plans. Thurgood Marshall had been considered public enemy number one in the South because of his court victories upending many of the laws of segregation. With Johnson's nomination of Marshall, it was as if the president were hammering the final nail into the coffin of white supremacy. "Thurgood," LBJ said to Marshall, "I'm nominating you because you're a lot like me. Bigger than life, and we come from the same kind of people." There had never been a president with the kind of ease around blacks that Lyndon Johnson possessed. Johnson knew how much it meant to Louis Martin to be in the White House on this day. Johnson finally rose from the sofa after ordering Marshall to phone his wife, Sissy, and inform her of what was about to happen. Johnson began to lead the group outside. Louis Martin was an emotional sort. He had desperately wanted to get a job on a major newspaper after taking his journalism degree from the University of Michigan in 1934. But major newspapers were not hiring blacks. He wound up in Cuba writing freelance articles before returning to America and editing a small Negro newspaper. Whenever he'd run into Thurgood Marshall, airports, train stations, Chicago or Harlem barrooms, they'd get to reminiscing about all the things they'd seen: Negro chain gangs, segregated movie theaters, all-white police departments. They'd get to recalling those restaurants that made them go around the back just to get a sandwich. Now this, a Supreme Court nomination. Louis Martin was so sentimental that he would often cry when there was some kind of exalted Negro achievement to celebrate. big tears welling up in his eyes. As President Johnson began to speak alongside Thurgood Marshall, Louis Martin began sobbing for two reasons. The first was sheer joy in how happy he was for Marshall. The second reason was worry and fear. He knew how difficult the looming battle for confirmation was going to be. When Johnson and Marshall finally emerged from the White House, walking toward the Rose Garden and the bank of microphones, members of the press suddenly looked up. Some squinted to see more clearly against the glare of sunlight as the hum of whispering began. When Marshall himself was unmistakably spotted just over the president's left shoulder, the air filled with heightened curiosity. Reporters started jockeying for better positions. Photographers raised their cameras. There was a feeling something profound was about to happen. There were many people who wrote letters to their senators and to President Lyndon Johnson. One of those letters came from a family that lived in a small town in Arkansas. I'm sure those family members loved one another. The last line of their letter to their senator was, "Please, sir, no nigger on the Supreme Court bench. Sincerely yours, the Harshaw family." There was another letter. I came across this letter in the archives of Senator John McClellan, who was an Arkansas senator and a segregationist. He had been a former prosecutor and told people in his native state in 1967 that he was going to do everything he could to stop Thurgood Marshall from reaching the highest court in the land. When I was looking through the McClellan archives, I came across this letter on my last day there. The archives had been shut for 50 years and only opened 2 weeks after I began my research into this book. This letter thoroughly convinced me why it was important to do this book. It was written on July 19, 1967, the second day of the Marshall hearings. It came from 2103 Delaware Street, Texarkana, Arkansas. It says, "Dear Senator McClellan, I am a resident of Arkansas and a law-abiding citizen who believes strongly in God, the United States Constitution, and justice for all. Recently, I read an article concerning remarks made by you and another senator about Solicitor General Thurgood Marshall, who is trying to become an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Sir, I am a Negro and an American. I want you to know how I feel about Mr. Marshall's nomination. I'm sure that I can speak for all the Negroes in Arkansas. Mr. Marshall is just as qualified as any likely candidate that you know. It has been made quite clear which side you are on. We all know why you and the other Southern senators don't want him to be on the Supreme Court, and it's not because of the U.S. Constitution. Mr. Marshall doesn't lack inequalities. You don't want him because he's black, and that is the only reason. Stop covering up behind some excuse. Chances are that the nomination will be turned down. But we hope and pray that you will open up your heart and let all of the hatred out and allow Mr. Marshall's record to speak for itself. Color doesn't make the person, Senator. It is character that makes the man. If he doesn't get the nomination, there will be others who will seek after the same opportunity when it presents itself. There will be hundreds, Senator, and you can't fight them all. One of these days, the President of the United States will be a Negro. Sincerely yours, Barbara Ross. The letter stopped me in my tracks. She predicted the very president we have in the White House today, and she did that in 1967. When I finish this book, when I finish writing this book, and told my two sisters that story, they said, "Wow, you have to go through Arkansas when you're on your book tour and find an heir of Barbara Ross and give her family a copy of your book." And I'm a trained newspaper man, so I got to thinking, you know, that's right. I certainly should do that. So I called the city clerk in Texarkana, Arkansas, 3 months ago, and I said, "My name is Will Haygood, and I have just spent 5 years working on a book about the nomination to the Supreme Court in 1967 of Thurgood Marshall. And I have a letter that's in my book that was written from a Barbara Ross in Texarkana. And I want to find, you know, her granddaughter or her daughter or her son or her grandson to tell them that this letter is in my book." And so the clerk said, "Well, let me look around. I do know some Rosses, and I'll see what I can do for you." About a week later, and I came home, and there was a message on my phone, and it just said, "Mr. Haygood, you should call this number in Texarkana." And they didn't say anything else, so I called the number, and a frail voice answered and said, "Hello." I said, "Hello, hi. Somebody down at the city clerk's office called and left this number for me. My name is Will Haygood. I'm trying to find any family member of Miss Barbara Ross, because I've written a book, and a letter that she wrote is in this book." And the voice said, "Well, my name is Barbara Ross." And so it threw me for a minute, and I said, "Well, would you be, like, named after her?" "Her daughter, perhaps?" And she said, "No, I am Barbara Ross." on the letter that I have, of course, I had it in front of me as I made this phone call, and the return address was 2103 Delaware Street. That address is now seared in my memory. I said, Mrs. Ross, where were you living in the summer of 1967? She said, oh, that's easy. I was living at 2103 Delaware Street. Why? And I said, well, Mrs. Ross, I am speechless. You are the same Barbara Ross who wrote the letter about Thurgood Marshall to Senator John McClellan, right? And she said, oh, my Lord. My daddy had bought me a manual typewriter, Christmas 1966. I was a sophomore in college. And I took that typewriter out back and wrote a letter to the senator. And my professors told me that I was going to get in a lot of trouble. But I felt so strongly about Mr. Marshall. And I told her that she was my new hero. I can't wait to get out to the Southwest on my book tour because I'm going to go and visit her and take her a copy of this book. A simple, beautiful, passionate, defiant letter. It was a tough nomination battle for Thurgood Marshall because he had won some titanic cases at the Supreme Court on voting rights, housing rights, equality. Southerners loathed him because he had changed their way of life. I was down in Mississippi. I was talking to a man who was now in his early 70s, and he told me when he was growing up, he said, my father would tell me, if you're bad, Thurgood Marshall's going to come and get you. This scene here is about the day of the vote. Lyndon Johnson had been so nervous that he had in mind a second black nominee if Thurgood Marshall would not be able to get all the votes that he needed. And it was a tough summer, 1967, and the Southerners thought Thurgood Marshall was soft on crime. They thought he hung around communists. They attacked him because his wife happened to be Asian. But Lyndon Johnson hung in there, and here's the scene on the day of the vote. White House aides had been tabulating numbers in the days leading up to the vote. While a nominee requires 50 votes to pass, the important number for the White House was 60 votes, the number needed to avoid a filibuster. Told in the days leading up to the vote that they had 50 votes, enough for confirmation, Johnson was focused on the 60 votes needed to stop a threatened filibuster. If the Southerners managed to stop the White House at 60 votes, they could filibuster the nomination into oblivion, and LBJ knew it. With the turmoil in the streets, he simply could not afford a filibuster. And that is what he told those senators on the other end of his phone calls. Strategically, he courted Southern senators who listened to him when he urged them to not vote, because if they did not vote, their votes would not show up in the figures to be released to the public. After 6 hours, it was finally agreed that there would be no more delays. The time had come to vote. Senator Mansfield opened the voting, and soon there were the echoes throughout the chamber. Aiken, yay! Anderson, yay! Byrd, nay! Eastland, nay! Hill, nay! Sparkman, nay! Church, yay! Lawshy, yay! Pale, yay! Percy, yay! Symington, yay! Thurman, nay! Some of the votes were uttered in even monotones, while others soared high in volume, causing necks to crane throughout the galleries. Kennedy, yay! Lone, nay! When it was all over, the final tally showed 69-31. LBJ and his White House aides had prevailed, however, to make a vote that could have been 69-31 magically turn into 69-11. Those 20 Southerners who had been threatened by LBJ were fearful enough of him that they did not vote. Thurgood Marshall was going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Phil Hart of Michigan, who floor managed the vote, nearly wept. A huge smile crossed his face. All the senators who had fought for Marshall started reaching out to one another to shake hands. They had made history, and they realized it. Senator Mike Mansfield could not hold back his emotions. He glanced around the Senate from side to side. They all set their eyes upon him. Then he spoke in a voice clear and strong. "Mr. President, the confirmation of the nomination of Thurgood Marshall as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court is also a confirmation of the vitality of the democratic system. It is a tribute to the good sense of you, President Johnson, who made this nomination, and to the judgment of the Senate, which has now approved it. The confirmation means that a man who loves the law and who has a firm respect and high faith in it moves to the top of his profession by entering the highest judicial body in the United States. Thurgood Marshall's rise to the Supreme Court reaffirms the American ideal that what counts is what you are and not who you are or whom your antecedents may have been. This is a shining hour, Mr. President, for Thurgood Marshall, for you, for the Senate, and for the United States of America. We have come a long, long way toward equal access to the Constitution's promise. I join my colleagues in the Senate in extending sincere congratulations to Mr. Justice Marshall on this most auspicious day in his life." A short while later, word reached the newest member of the U.S. Supreme Court that he would have to report to be measured for his judicial robes. And this last scene sort of takes in the arc of Thurgood Marshall's life. He seemed to fall out of favor after he left the bench. Many people thought that he was angry because the Supreme Court had shifted to the right once he was there. And then there was a slow renaissance, and that's what I talk about. Artists and organizations had long been taking note of Thurgood Marshall's historical in port. In 2008, the gifted actor Lawrence Fishburne opened on Broadway at the Booth Theater in Thurgood, a one-man play which told of the justice's sweeping life. It was a much lauded performance and was later telecast on HBO. Visitors to San Francisco's Grace Cathedral could look up at the Human Endeavor windows and see all the windows that were named in honor of heroic figures and their craft. Albert Einstein had a window for natural science. The window belonging to Jane Addams was for social work. The window for Robert Frost for letters. Thurgood Marshall's window for law, like the others, set up high in the cathedral nave. The church would only grant you a window if it had accepted you into the realm of sainthood. On his editorial page on March 6, 2011, the New York Times penned an editorial simply titled Thurgood Marshall. It was unusual on that page to have a life revisited after the passage of so much time. It was a lovely and tender tribute about the ongoing artistic homage being paid to Marshall's life. On the Supreme Court today, the editorial said, there is no justice who seems similarly placed there to speak for the powerless by such a sweeping tide of history. There is no one whose life translates so magisterially into art. All of the attention gained Thurgood Marshall new admirers. Tourists would troop out to Arlington National Cemetery to visit his gravesite. The cemetery sat on land once owned by a prominent Confederate family. After the Civil War in the South's defeat, the land would be sold to the federal government. Old and bent and jubilee singing Negroes, fresh from the slave plantations, would trudge into Washington without places to stay, hoping their government would help them. Many who were penniless were reduced to foraging for food. They were often given housing on the site of the cemetery itself, a part of which was called Freedman's Village. These were the very people whom Secretary of War Edwin Stanton had appealed to for help during the massive manhunt to bring President Lincoln's assassin to justice. And when the final gust of breath had left the former plantation residents, they would be placed in spare wooden coffins and lowered into the earth on the same grounds where Thurgood Marshall, who had worked to free their descendants, would be laid to rest years later, allowing the wind to blow eternally over their gathered souls. Thank you. And I was told that we'd have a little time for some questions, and so I'll take those questions.
How do you explain Lyndon Johnson's views, his support of civil rights, Thurgood Marshall, all of that given his upbringing?
Wonderful question. Franklin Delano Roosevelt appointed Johnson National Youth Director for the state of Texas in the 1930s. And his mission was to drive around and visit with poor people and try to help them find jobs. Most of those people he met were black. He did not like the way that they were living. And because he had grown up poor himself. Thurgood Marshall went to Texas a lot to file civil rights lawsuits. One was in 1944. It was known as Smith v. Allwright. I'm sure some of you have heard of that case. I'm sure there are some lawyers here. But that case enabled blacks at long last to vote in the all-white Texas Democratic primary. Lyndon Johnson was a young senator, and blacks started voting for him in droves. And he was sent back to the Senate time and time again, and he rose, as we know, in seniority. And he became leader of the Senate. With those black votes that were a result of Smith v. Allwright. So you really can look at it this way. No Thurgood Marshall, no Lyndon Johnson. And he knew that. And there was a very poignant conversation that Lyndon Johnson had after he left the White House and went back to his ranch in Texas. Marshall was on the Supreme Court, and Lyndon Johnson phoned him. I found this transcript of this phone conversation when I went out to Texas to do research. And Lyndon Johnson said, "Thurgood, I'm going to write a book. It's going to be a book about the hell you put me through to get you onto the Supreme Court. Because you put me through hell." And Thurgood said, "Mr. President, I'll forever be grateful. And anything I can do to help you with that book, then I'll surely do it." Lyndon Johnson died 5 months later and never got a chance to write that book. When I told my niece that, she said, "Wow, Uncle Will, you've now written the book that the president wanted to write." And I said, "Wow, that's a nice line. I think I'll use that on my book tour." Next question.
As I recall, William Coleman, a distinguished Philadelphia lawyer, was the second choice. Did you interview him?
Yes, I did. He was wonderful, too. And there's a whole chapter about him in the book. He was summoned to the White House on the second day because Lyndon Johnson had gotten very nervous because Marshall had a very, very tough day. He was grilled. And as I said, every Supreme Court nominee, their hearings before Thurgood Marshall had lasted less than a day. It was just a rubber stamp thing for any nominee to go through, but they changed the rules on Thurgood Marshall. And Lyndon Johnson was so nervous when the hearings didn't end after one day or 2 days that he summoned from Philadelphia. Mr. Coleman went right down to 30th Street Station and hopped on the train. He did not know why he was being summoned to Washington, so he got to the White House and he got to talking to the president, who said, "Bill, my man might not make it. And if he doesn't, I want to put a black, very qualified, both of these gentlemen." Thurgood Marshall graduated number one in his law class at Howard University, at the very top. Turned down a fellowship to go to Harvard after law school. And William Coleman said, I love Thurgood Marshall, and I don't want to do anything but support him. And I cannot accept that. William Coleman had worked with Marshall on the 1954 Brown school decision. But he did say, I will go around and talk to senators who aren't quite sure that they want to support Marshall. And but that's a great unknown story.
How important were the secret Johnson tapes for your research, and how do you feel about, you know, now, you know, in the current political world that, you know, sort of everyone is so afraid to leave a record in a sense?
It was definitely a much different time. I don't think Lyndon Johnson was fearful of what folks might say down the road. He used very raw language. He didn't go to law school. Not to diss lawyers, but like, I'm glad he didn't go to law school, because lawyers can often hem and haw and argue to get their way. I happen to be dating a lady who's a lawyer, and I swear I lose every argument, baby. Come on, baby, give me a break tonight. Yeah, dog. So I'll probably get in trouble if she hears this on the podcast.
Talk a bit about the relationship between Thurgood Marshall and Dr. King.
Marshall admired King, but Marshall did not like the fact that King marched with kids in the South, and those kids often were fire hosed or thrown in jail. So Thurgood Marshall had spent so much time in the South visiting Southern jails, and he had seen how inmates had been beaten up. He would constantly tell King, you have to obey the law. He never wavered from that. He couldn't understand, because Marshall fought through the court system, and some of the reviews of this book have said that that King has gotten all of the credit, moral credit, for the civil rights movement, and he certainly earned that, and he paid with his life, and he was a great moral leader. There is no doubt about that. But Marshall was certainly the legal giant of civil rights and human rights law in this country. He didn't make the headlines. Law work sometimes, drudge work slow, it's painstaking. He'd lose a case, he'd file an appeal, he'd go back to court. the newspaper people weren't there when he filed the appeal. Some of my students have never heard the name Thurgood Marshall. Never. I think I got a little idea. I think I might have to teach Showdown.
I want to ask you a contemporary question.
Okay.
Senator Ted Cruz recently said that 5 unelected lawyers have too much power, describing the Supreme Court, and that we should find a way to rein that in and give go back to the Constitution, something like that. What's your perspective on that statement and how it pertains historically?
Well, first of all, I don't live on the same planet as Ted Cruz. Yeah, let me get that straight. Marshall was fascinated with the law. I don't know if this is going to answer that question, but I think it's going to say something that's important. 5-4 decisions. And we've been getting a lot of them from the Supreme Court. Marshall was fascinated with the law because he saw the law with Plessy v. Ferguson subjugating blacks, shoving them down. You're separate. That means that your school buses won't be as good. Your sewer services won't be as good. But you're still equal. Still equal to the shiny new school buses over here. And Marshall had to figure out a way, some sort of tapestry, to defeat Plessy v. Ferguson. And it's mind-blowing when you look at it this way. Everywhere Marshall went, 90% of the places he wasn't wanted. And just think of that. I mean, you have to go and be on top of your game, and you're not wanted. The night before, and you might not have been able to get a decent meal in the town, had to sit in the back. Somebody called you the N-word. Somebody spit on you. He was arrested. But his weapon was the U.S. Constitution. He carried it around in his vest pocket. And he would tell these state judges and federal judges, you're breaking the law. You're breaking the law. And it says it right here in the U.S. Constitution. So he set about winning these cases. He went before the Supreme Court 32 times. Most lawyers don't even do it once. He won 29 cases. Smith v. Allwright was a Texas voting case. Shelley v. Kramer was a housing case. Sweat v. Painter was the University of Texas law school case, which he made Texas except blacks. In his titanic victory, Brown v. Board of Education. So those four cases really formed the foundation of the 1964 Civil Rights Bill and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So it's an amazing legacy that Thurgood Marshall left. And I thought that it was very important to tell it through 5 days of those Senate hearings. Marshall was asked a lot by Southern senators. What do you feel about these 5-4 rulings? And Marshall said, well, there's nothing I can do about them except accept them. Oh, hi, how are you?
Hi, good, how are you?
I last saw you in Washington, D.C., right?
Yeah, at a writer's conference.
How's your yoga business?
It's going well, yes. It's going better now that you've given me some free PR, but yeah, it's going well.
See?
So I just wanted to ask, Will, in the course of your research, I'm sure you came across many personal and professional stories about Thurgood Marshall, but which one most personally tugged at your heartstrings? Which was one of the more touching stories or anecdotes that you can tell us?
Okay, yes. Harry and Harriet Moore were voting rights activists in Florida. They returned to their home on Christmas Eve, 1955, and went to bed. Their house blew up. It was Ku Klux Klansmen who had placed dynamite there on Christmas Eve. Mr. Moore, Harry Moore, who had had dinner with Thurgood Marshall 3 months earlier in that same house, Marshall had spent a night in that house. Harry Moore died. His wife, Harriet, held on. One day, 2 days, 3 days. Their daughter, Evangeline Moore, was on a train trying to get home for Christmas because she was in a segregated rail car. Nobody thought to get a message to her to tell her what had happened. She got off the train. She didn't see her mother and father. She saw aunt and uncle and her sister, and she said, where's mama? Where's daddy? And they said to her, they said, Evangeline, your father has been killed, and your mother is in the hospital, and she wants to see you right away. She said, this can't be. It's Christmas. This can't be. When she got to the hospital on the fifth day, the doctor told her and her sister, look, if your mother can hold on for 7 days, we think she might make it. Harriet Moore died on the sixth day. Mrs. Moore, the daughter who was on that segregated train, lives in Maryland, and I went to visit her, Thurgood Marshall, after it happened, flew to Florida to launch his own investigation. J. Edgar Hoover knew he was going down there, didn't want him to go. After 4 days, Marshall knew it was time to go. He couldn't call the airport ahead of time because somebody at the airport might tell some hooligans that Thurgood Marshall is on his way to the airport. So Marshall came out of the little motel where he was staying at, and a friend of his was going to drive him to the airport. And these two men, they were white and they were very tough looking, they started walking toward the car. Thurgood Marshall, he tensed up. One of the men asked Thurgood Marshall to roll down the window, and he said, we're FBI agents. Showed him their badges, and they said, Mr. Hoover has sent us down here to make sure that you get back to Washington, D.C. safely. They reached the airport and they walked up to the ticket to buy Marshall's ticket. And then the clerk said, there are no more seats. There are no seats for you. And this would be a great scene in the movie if they make it. The FBI agent leaned over, got nose to nose and said, lady, you better find a ticket for this man right now. And 30 minutes later, Thurgood Marshall was walking onto the plane. I got to tell Lee Daniels that story. Now, here is the part that gets deeper. So when I was interviewing Mrs. Moore, no Christmas for her has ever been the same since. And I felt so sorry for her. I'm there for like 4 hours. And before I leave, I'm sitting in her living room. And before I leave, she asked me if I can come to her kitchen to help her pull something down from a high shelf. And I said, of course. So we went through her dining room and I stopped. I stopped because of what I saw. I stopped. And I said, Mrs. Moore, why didn't you tell me that this was here? There was an oil painting, 4 feet by 6 feet, gigantic. And I'm just staring at it. It wasn't Harriet Moore. It wasn't Harry Moore. It was Thurgood Marshall. And I said, Mrs. Moore, why is this here? And she says, well, on the day that Thurgood Marshall was confirmed, some friends of my family knew how close he was to my father, and they sent this to me as a gift. I tell that story in the book. One more question.
Hey, Mr. Haygood. It's nice to meet you. I'm currently in 9th grade, and I attend Dobbins. And I would like to know, do you consider the Thurgood Marshall one of your, like, all-time heroes?
He was so brave, and my mother from Selma, Alabama, that civil rights soaked city, she had a set of twins in 1954. That was the year of freedom for black school children. And I know she dreamed that those twins would be able to go to a good school that was equal. One of those twins was the first of her children to go to college. And so Thurgood Marshall is on my Mount Olympus because I am that twin. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.